This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
I'm joined here with Gio Penachietti. He's a social impressionist painter and writer from the first post-National Nation, and also a gonzo philosopher and failed academic. That's just how he describes himself on YouTube. He's also the host of Giant Art Productions on YouTube, and also a host on the Break the Rules podcast. Gio, great having you on, and also Matt Pegas is here to co-host.
Yo, thank you for inviting me. This is you're the first one to actually get my last name like correctly. It's Penachietti, but people just it's easier to say Penachetti. But yeah, this is great. I mean, I've been following Stark Truth Radio for years, and you've had some pretty like I would say important notable guests. So, and we finally got the chance do the job together, as they say in wrestling. So,
yeah, the first time I came across your online presence was when you were describing my book, Journey to Vapor Island, as degenerate.
Yeah, that was many moons ago. But I subsequently read Journey to Vapor Island, and I quite enjoyed it. I think, like, it's really weird, our paths have sort of crossed. I remember, when you, like, came, like, were more, well-known on Twitter, I'm like, oh my god, you wrote Journey to Vapor Island, and you're like, well, you call my book degenerate back in the day. I go, oh man, I think, like, Journey to Vapor Island to me is, like, such a trip in terms of being like one of the most, and I say this totally in a good way, one of like the most infamous pieces of alt literature that internet culture has ever produced. And I think like in some ways you could say it is kind of like a capsule in time of what was going on at the, like, very much like the stuff that we're a product of in the, like, what would you even describe it as, like post-gamer gay frog Twitter type of stuff that was hovering
around.
Yeah,
I do think I have a sequel to that book, which is coming out this summer. But looking back on it, like, I do think there are references that are a bit dated. It did kind of coincide the 2016 election with Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very much like, just as a disclaimer, and people who listen to the show know this, Gio may not, I wasn't even into this stuff back then, so I can't even really fully claim this, but basically my impression is that it really captures that Chatelet Trump 2016 moment pretty well in terms of memes. But I have to ask, actually, because I wasn't there this time, and I never really talked to Robert, did Journey to Vapor Island, it made a pretty big splash on Twitter when it first came out then, is my understanding. Like, people were talking about it on Frog Twitter and such.
Oh yeah. It was pretty popular in the chants.
A famous detractor.
Oh, really? Because I was never that active on the chants. Like, my impression was that that I got some excellent reviews, but I didn't really get the impression that it really took off.
It kind of did, but it's kind of hard to tell with Lit, because usually Lit, they have this like tendency to just like shred everything that someone like actually goes out and does on their own. So there was people that, like, I'm not going to lie, there were some pretty harsh critics, but then there were people that realized, like, it was, in some ways, a perfect encapsulation of that moment in time. And it, just, like, there was, like, so many things there. Like, so, so many, like, avenues of offense that it was just like, oh my god. It really was again, I don't want to, like, put some rose-colored glasses on that particular period, because, of course, I see the downside to a lot of what happened, like, post-2016 with, like, the whole OG Frog... I wouldn't even say Frog Twitter, when it became more, like, mainstream after Gamergate with, like, Trump and, like, there truly was kind of, like, a 60s moment for the political right in some ways. And now... it's kind of like with Joe Biden, it's kind of like we're all waking up to Richard Nixon in 1971, and it's like that spirit has kind of been severely muted, but I don't know, I mean, all the interesting things happened in the 70s, so you never know, but I think it was pretty much a capstone.
Oh yeah, 70s, I do think, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but it's hard to make these predictions, but I think 70s would maybe be the best comparison for the 2020s, but I find it so affable when you have, like, these boomers on the mainstream media actually saying that we're going to have, like, another 1920s.
Oh, God, yeah. I think that is... A lot of people, they talk about, like, this was a meme back then, too, was the Wimerica thing. But I think, like, people are saying it's not so much that we're... Well, I mean, we kind of do exist within a, like, Weimar culture, but it's more so... That it's like, think of what happened in the like late 80s, early 90s Soviet Union collapsing. That's sort of like, I don't think it's exactly a pretty good comparison. I mean, unless we have total balkanization, but there's still like a lot of, how shall I put it, harmonious qualities to these different periods. And now we're sort of, it's sort of coinciding with our era, and who knows what's going to happen, because there's so many different and more unique factors to what we're going through. But I don't know. This is all just speculation.
Obviously. Oh, yeah. It's just speculating to make these predictions. But with the review, you did this excellent review of my artwork. But I think you did say that the book, actually, Journey to Vapor Island, that the visual art actually fits the same vibe of the literary work.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I like to see, I'm like, someone told me once, they're like, yeah, you're like the only YouTuber or one of the only ones like in this space that, because like there's a lot of YouTubers and, you know, you've interviewed a fair bit of them. I mean, a lot of them, let's face it, they've been banned, but they focus on like pop culture, they'll focus on films, and you know, films, I mean, there's a lot of depth to critiquing films, but it gets sort of like, it becomes kind of easy content after a while. But I mean, when it comes to specifically visual art, I noticed that in our sort of circles, there's like a lack of that type of content. But yeah, I think like visually, your paintings, when you read like Journey to Vapor Island, it brings it together in that like, retro-futurist, like, sleaze type of aesthetic that in some ways is very appealing and very sensuous, but in, like, a very raunchy sort of way. It's hideous in a good way. Put it that way, Rob. It's hideous in a good way.
So. Oh, yeah, you described it as Fauvist vaporwave, genres ranging from Italian futurism to mid-century modern to 80s, oh, yeah, are kind of mentioned, and those are the genres, more genres of the 20th century, where there's this kind of a constant, and some criticisms of those genres as well, and since they replace like the more traditional local, oh, yeah, aesthetic that is more perennial, and they're not super tonalist. There is transitions in shading, but there are, like, similar to Fauvism, like these big kind of blocks of color. But yeah, like the theme of aesthetic exploration of the locations is one of them, and then dreamlike quality being pulled into a vortex. Then you mentioned the garish elements to decadent excess, and then with like the paintings of Vegas, you do get into some of those dynamics. So you mentioned that some directors said Vegas is a playground for slaves, but there's like a longing, well, especially today's Vegas, like I think... that's what it's become, but there's like a longing for sort of older decadence and like the hauntological, like lost futures, what retrofuturism is, like the future we could have had returning to futures past. Like, what that era when we had these, like, really kind of lavish interiors, like, what it said about our society of, like, leisure, free time, and access of wealth is shown off. And then kind of contrasting that with a lot of this this trend, like, towards minimalism today and really kind of sterile interiors, like, things that become... Aesthetics has become much more practical, like, what my visual work says about these social and historical aesthetic trends.
Yeah, there's kind of, like, multiple... this seems like some gay academic way of talking about it, but I'll... Like, there's multiple levels of irony to this kind of art and to vaporwave as an aesthetic, where it's like, yeah, it's kind of ironic and it's kind of garish, but also it's kind of nice, and maybe even if, and I've written about this a little bit, like, you know, you could look at something like a mall, which is a common vaporwave symbol, and something that Robert has painted, and or even Vegas, and you could say these are the products of consumerism and they're soulless, but at the same time, in comparison with today, in comparison with minimalism, whatever you want to call it, they at least represented a time when they had their own sort of affect, so to speak. Even if they're examples of the classic, like, postmodern waning of affect thing, like, these things are now old enough that they kind of have their own, they encapsulate their own time period. So that's where the sort of layers of irony or distance come in, where it's like you don't know whether something's ironic or not. But ultimately, I think it's not ironic, and there's a sincere yearning expressed by these kinds of aesthetics.
It very much is like a post-sincerity, or sorry, a new sincerity. I personally, like, I don't like the term metamodern because, like, let's face the people that created the term are bug men, so that's...
Yeah.
I
am familiar. I know what you mean, yeah. Like, it's like neo-sincerity, but... And I used to kind of go into that rabbit hole of trying to figure out what the hell it meant, and I don't really care what it means, but also it is useful to think about anything that goes beyond postmodernism.
Yeah, and I think that, to me, being sort of a... Well, defender is this kind of weird word. Being someone who thinks that, you know, from the very beginning that we should, in my work, in my writings, and even in some ways in my art, that we have to sort of come to terms with postmodernism. There is something to how these non-spaces, like the mall, like these very, like, monumentally, you know, festering neon distractions of consumerism, like Las Vegas as a whole.
It's a big theme of having, I don't necessarily embrace this, obviously, but, like, a traditionalist type will say, or reactionary will say, that it's nostalgia for earlier stages of liberalism and consumerism. So an outright reactionary or traditionalist will actually reject that, but I don't necessarily agree with that point. But, like, we do need to create something new, and we can sort of borrow from different pieces from the past, but I don't necessarily agree with that perspective.
Oh, no, what I was going to say, I would agree with you more. I do think they are early stages of liberalism. Let's not be, like, kidding.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But I do agree with you, Robert, that I agree with both of you in the sense that I feel that there's beyond, like, just the nostalgia of, like, the, what would you say, particularly Gen X, like, why can't we go back to 90s liberalism? I think, like, if you were to bracket politics for a minute, you would say that there's a nostalgia for our direct past, and being, like, an older millennial, I think that is the space that we inhabit, because we were literally on the cusp of two different worlds and two different ontologies that were fundamentally opposed. And so when you have this dramatic tension, notice how the lost futures, the ontology, comes about from what is the most immediate to us, the 80s, the 90s, and to some degree the 70s.
I saw a video, I'm not sure if you know who Coach Blackpill is, but he made, like,
Kevin Stark,
He made the comparison that, like, the ontology of the dead malls, it kind of parallels, like, one's personal sense of lost youth. And that especially applies to, like, the generation of older millennials and younger Gen X, too.
Yeah,
because you're on the cusp of, as Gio said, between, like, you know, empire and post-empire, however we want to put it, like, the end of America as we knew it versus whatever it is now. I mean, yeah, I think that the most operative thing is the nostalgia itself almost, and it's like because that's a thing that we actually have access to. It's not just like the whole, like the old, this is dated to even talk about, but the old meme of like the woman in the cornfield and stuff like that. Like, we don't actually have access to that, most of us, so.
No, that's a fantasy.
Yeah, like there's a more real nostalgia.
So yeah, I would agree. So I would actually make the case that ironically that like nostalgia for 80s mall is more trad, because fantasizing about some idealized vision of the 19th century, that, I mean, that's more of a product of liberalism because it's based on maybe
a fantasy
or even like kind of a Disney movie image. So I'd make the case that's actually more liberal.
It's like boomers with like Norman Rockwell paintings. So.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It is kind of like that for millennials of a certain age and for Gen X. And I'm just reminded, one point I want to interject because I think it's useful. It's kind of an ironic source, or not ironic. It's kind of a funny source. But if you guys know the musician Xurious, he did an interview with Greg at Countercurrents. And,
oh yeah, I heard that one.
Describing like, and he makes synthwave or fashwave. So to speak.
Oh, that guy. Yeah.
And I mean, the interview's good in general because I do enjoy him as a musician, but the part of it that actually has really stuck with me on like a deeper spiritual and philosophical level is that how he described, like, his music draws from the 80s, as a lot of like vaporwave and fashwave aesthetics did, but it's not that he thinks the 80s were so great, it's just the nostalgia itself to him. And some of the symbols from that time, to him, that spoke of sort of like, what exactly he said was more eloquent than this, but just that the seed of nostalgia in our soul is ultimately, even if it's over something like 80s malls, is ultimately rooted to man's longing to be reunited with the divine. Well, and yes, that's a very highfalutin way of putting it, but that actually, yeah, spiritually, I relate to that.
Well, it becomes a reified spiritual quality. Now, I have my criticisms of Fashwave, maybe if you wanted to get into that, but I think that it's true because that nostalgia itself, the problem, the problem with Fashwave and a lot of that stuff is that the nostalgia doesn't reach past itself. It doesn't self-overcome. It could provoke the seeds of self-overcoming to arrive at a sort of, I guess, you would say like a neo trad futurism or something, some kind of like weird archaeo futurist concept of, you know, seeing our way through rather than total full-on rejection. I also think that a lot of it is because the 80s was a time of rediscovery of, in terms of aesthetics, you had this like neo art deco sort of movement where it embodied like hyper-capitalist Americana empire to where that one, like at the very small window in history where those things actually had like the inkling of Faustian man.
Yeah.
Like what the 80s said about a lot of the kind of ironies, because there's one view that it is synonymous with like crass consumerism. But I guess obviously a big part of the nostalgia was it was really like the last era of great kind of this perception of American greatness. And then by the 90s, there was this kind of decline, gradual, and then a big decline after 2010. But the thing is there's also, like, what it says about, like, a kind of Promethean aesthetic, too. And a lot of these kind of postmodernist 80s malls, they would maybe pay homage to genres of the past, like the Victorian shopping arcade, or Art Deco, or some kind of ancient city. Like, the kind of aesthetics... The aesthetic appeal of Trump was part of it too.
Yeah.
And then he kind of lost that. Like Trump went from 80s retrofuturism to giving these kind of his speeches were just seemed like a pretty generic, like kind of county fair. So aesthetics are crucial to politics. And then kind of looking over this trend, it's getting a bit cliche, but we keep talking about in the show how the kind of these kind of minimalistic trends. You see in like office spaces and shopping complexes are about kind of concealing inequality, in wealth and power. And then you had this video on neoliberal kitsch, radical liberal realism, which actually does reappropriate the kitsch from Americana, but molds it into this kind of new, the woke era. So yeah, like, what are your overall thoughts on the symbolism, the political symbolisms within aesthetics? And do you have any thoughts on, like, the political trends, the aesthetic trends relating to politics of where we're headed this upcoming decade in the 2020s.
Wow, thank you. That's, wow, I could go on forever about this. I'm glad you liked that video. Me and, on my channel, I'm co-host of Breakthrough Rules podcast, but me and another great artist friend of mine, Matthew the Stout, we also have a podcast, Style Talks, where it's exclusively about art. And we recently released an episode about the Sanford Bigger statue in that everyone was freaking out about. But we go into the
is
other
that
the
are, one in Rockefeller,
yes,
Center?
Rockefeller,
because
Center.
I recently interviewed Jason Reza-Giorgiani. He was outraged about this, but not like the normal reaction. Like, he has his own political philosophy of Prometheism, so it's more like but just kind of the desecration of this temple of Prometheus. Like, what? Like, Promethean aesthetics, and I'm obviously not a fan of the statue, but a lot of those responses on right-wing and trad Twitter were pretty cliche or even pretty cringe.
Yeah, we go into that, and I think that me and Matthew, we have similar conclusions to Giorgiani. I mean, I could bring this up. Apparently in August on BTR, we're also, he's going to grace our presence. But, I mean, as much as I have, me being a Catholic, as much as I disagree with him, I think I saw that you interviewed Giorgiani, and I have to, it's out now, right? I think I could.
Okay, it's not out as we're recording, but will be posted before the show gets posted.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
Also, we've been, Robert and I, and Robert and our friend Francis, I mean, there's a few interviews already from this year with Giorgiani, so you may have seen one of those.
Oh, yeah, that was the one I saw, yeah.
I would like to see you bring Giorgiani onto your podcast and maybe have, like, a friendly debate. So, he does pretty much strongly reject Christianity and Catholicism.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he got into it with my friend Joel recently, besides that, what you asked was a great question. By the way, before we continue, shout out to Pill Eater, Francis.
Yeah.
He's a good friend of mine as well. Great dude. He's been on BTR a few times, but I think on my channel I want to have like a few one-on-ones with him. But you said the aesthetic vision with neoliberal kitsch. So I bring this up because me and Matthew, I'm currently sketching out like a script for our next episode of Style Talks, and I eventually want to write like something like a full-length book on neoliberal kitsch and also on like Humans of Flat Design, but I have to coax a certain someone to co-author with me about flat design. But I think that in terms of, well, my thoughts on the Trump aesthetic, it's very apt because he went from initially this aesthetics of futurist raw power that was inhibited as this like 80s retro-futurist vibe. But as time goes on, as he had to appeal to more of the boomer constituency that does have money.
Another thing I find ironic is you have the kind of the wealthy, but also kind of geriatric kind of donor class. They were probably from that actual elite in the 80s, backing the more kind of really bland generic aesthetics, and then just appealing to kind of like the masses. But then you have like a lot of the people from the alt-right who are like, they're young men who are economically disenfranchised, but they're kind of embracing. What appealed to Trump was that Trump reflected the elite aesthetics, but from the past. So that's interesting too.
But
what you were going to say about Trump's aesthetics and then also neoliberal realism.
Yeah. I think, no, but that's a great point that I, it's sort of weird, like, why that is, why. I think maybe because younger people, they do inhabit some sort of thumos where, through their disenfranchisement, they want to embody a more powerful sort of aesthetic, even if it comes, I mean, anti-capitalism, and I'm certainly not a fan of capitalism, it's still, like, appealing in the sense of the way that Art Deco was. But I think that Trump, it is funny that these elites, the donor class, they were probably like moguls in the 80s, moguls and high rollers, but yet they still, as they get older, they have their own boomer nostalgia for their childhood. So as Trump goes on, it became more about like ridiculous, like McNaughton paintings where, Trump is kind of like a Norman Rockwell sort of figure, and it becomes more of like the county fair boomer sloganeering that you'd find like more appealing to Fox News constituency. They do have this like terribly parochial aesthetic that is, you know, the county fair barbecue, Fox News women, you know, bottle blondes. It's got this own flavor to it that doesn't, it's almost, I know this word keeps getting thrown around a lot everywhere, but it is very, like, sclerotic in nature. It's like, yeah, it's, I think, when Trump started to fail, it's because his aesthetics were not on point, and of course he, you know, kicked out some pretty good people. But that being said, about neoliberal kitsch, or radliberalism, I think, like, in a way, the aesthetics become prepackaged throughout our own era.
Yeah, it is based upon, like, the past. That's kind of the thing, is, like, it kind of relates to the right assumes the left is anti-American, but it kind of relates to this co-option of American civic nationalism, like with Hamilton's the best example of that. And that's the same with neoliberal kitsch, is taking classic Americana and then transforming it to kind of co-opting it into the new era that we're in now. I think conservatives they come across as pretty foolish when they say that the left just wants to dismantle and destroy America, but it's a co-option into something, co-option of Americanism into kind of the woke era.
Yeah, America is really their beast. And just to finish my point, I think that the aesthetics become prepackaged because they're very, like, you know, campy, gaudy, kitschy type of color palette, with a certain large activist group, which I won't get into, that recently changed their flag to be more inclusive, if you know what I mean. They're sort of like...
Oh, is that the new new rainbow flag?
Yeah, with the black bizarre and brown and the trans.
I think it's kind of bizarre because it's the same design as the South African flag. But
I wonder,
just,
it really makes you think. Does,
yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't consider myself along the vein of like countercurrents or like white nationalism. But at the same time, I can kind of see there's just, I don't know, there's some weird kind of synchronicity going on there with South African flag and that. But no, I think that the aesthetics become very much prepackaged and they become very much formalized along political lines, and that's the whole point. You mentioned about malls, and this came up with your great interview I was listening to with Blauergeist. Where you talked about the malls and how rich people now, they have adopted this minimalist IKEA aesthetic. I think to me that really is a form of aesthetic terrorism, a form of an aesthetic psyop, because when the mega wealthy, they refuse to cloak themselves within their own regalia, it very much is a distortion of the natural order of things. And we have elites that aren't specifically designed to, or born into being, you know, leaders. We have the bugocracy, and at the top of the verminoid heap, as Bap says, we have these hideous cryptoids that refuse to dress themselves as the true aristocrats, but rather inflict this bland minimalism upon people. And, you know, minimalism has its place, in my opinion, but I think that the world is becoming one giant non-place, and it's a form of psyop aesthetic terrorism. But sorry, I've been rambling.
If you look at these different cities, I think, like, New York, despite its flaws, does have a very kind of retro-futuristic feel.
Oh, yeah.
Also very gritty, but you're from Ontario, not Toronto, but Toronto, like, you're kind of talking about, like, where the aesthetic trends are going. I don't really know if the minimalism will continue throughout the 2020s. I've, like, seen some new proposals for, like, mega developments that maybe seem to be inspired by maybe a bit, something that might be a bit more retro-futurist. I'm actually not 100% pessimistic about aesthetics, but looking kind of at the 2010s trend, like Toronto, it is very futuristic, and they have, like, a lot of skyscrapers and, like, an underground city, but it's not retro-futuristic. I've never been to Canada, but from the photos that I've seen, like, my impression of Toronto and Vancouver, too, is that it is just, it's just all kind of like glass cubes, very futuristic, but also very minimalistic and sterile.
Futuristic in a bad way. Vancouver is a bit more redeemable, although the people are not redeemable, I hate to say it, because of their geographic location, that's pretty much it. But Toronto, and you talked about this with my good friend Bimbo Ubermensch, shout out to Bimbo, Toronto really is like the designer, like SimCity's default city of the future, where everyone is sort of segregated in their ethnic enclaves. No, nothing is original. There's only big brand box stores. It really is like Toronto. I hate to say it, is kind of, and I know this is probably going to bite me in the ass in the future, but Toronto is really spiritually humiliating on such a fundamental level with their aesthetics. So yeah.
I want to get back to that, but you did do a video on Italian futurism as both a political and arts movement. It didn't really take off, obviously, after the war. And Marinetti had radical ideas like destroying everything old, which obviously would alienate a lot of people. But it is relevant to the kind of retrofuturist scene where you break from the past, but there's also a fusion of the sacred with technological progress. And that's something, like, there's something really missing in futurism today. Like the degree of technological progress can be debated, because it does seem that we're just creating, like, new apps, and there's a lack of innovation. Some people talk about, like, a managed decline. There's a really lack of any kind of, like, futuristic vision. Basically, like, what people who call for retrofuturism would want to advocate, like, what is futurism today? It kind of relates to contrasting retrofuturism and Italian futurism, but you could even say, like, the idealism of, like, those who are into fashion wave, and then, like, what counts for futurism today with the example of Toronto.
Interesting. Well, Matt, you haven't talked in a while. Do you have any thoughts on this?
In terms of the future of the future, that's what you're asking about, right, Robert? Like, what is futurism today? Is that kind of what you're asking about?
Yeah, what is futurism today? And I'd also say that because of the internet, like, there's no, like, longer a monoculture. Like, looking at past generations, these 20th century trends with, like, the boomers, Gen X, millennials, it was kind of a disposable culture of reinventing oneself with all these different 20th century genres. But, like, looking at the Zoomers and the trends of the 21st century, it seems that there's actually no, because of the internet, people can sort of fragment into their own, yeah, like, cultural, aesthetic, and political bubbles.
Yeah, and let me ask this, like, when has it ever been the case that, like, that kind of, when has a subculture ever taken control of the future? I mean, that's the question, because
true.
We definitely don't live in a monoculture anymore. And, you know, I'm okay with, as you call it, I mean, it's speaking on something slightly different, but Robert, you've talked about panenclavism on, like, a social basis, but even, like, you know, subcultures online, like, different online scenes. It's all well and good. It feels like it's a natural thing to happen at this particular point, because no one trusts, like, the main narrative. However, it is not, it is not a fertile ground for futurism, because real futurism that isn't just, like, jacking off in VR, that isn't just, like, a projection, an imagination, I'll pose it as a question, like, can real, authentic futurism come out of anything but a monoculture? And I think that a lot of great thinkers would probably say no. I mean, not to wax too academic here, or like, pretend I'm some expert on Nietzsche, but, like, I know that Nietzsche wrote a lot about was very concerned with the declining horizon for the West, and I think that we're living in a moment where that process he delineated, where the horizon was closing, was getting smaller due to the dissolution of culture and decadence, is something that has hit a fever pitch, has become totalizing, and that's why we have hauntology instead of futurism, because a quote-unquote end point of history. There is no futurism, so we make up sort of aesthetic replacements.
Wow, that's fascinating. I would agree. The first thing that came to mind is Nietzsche, in the sense that him, like, starting off as a philologist, he said that the cultures that produced the greatest art in history were the ones that had a singular language, because they had the capacity to think universally within themselves in their own nation and culture. And so, I mean, of course, modern, like, you know, bugman historians disagree with this, but basically the cultures that could have, like, a single voice, they knew their place. I would argue slightly differently. I think that it is true, the thesis that some people like Sloterdijk say, that we do exist within the age of what he called foam, where it's like micro bubbles upon infinite matrices of just little subgenres. But I would say we do have a monoculture. It's just the monoculture is like terminally dead husk, dying civilization liberalism that people instinctually find to be spiritually alienating. But in terms of the futurism, I think the problem is that futurism should go, now that I'm thinking about it, my video, by the way, which was a thread by a very great mutual of mine who's followed me for many years, I think that's kind of like a, you would say, a sort of Christian response to someone like Giorgiani, who is a Promethean. It's something that, a space definitely to be explored. My problem with a lot of the futurism that tends to go about within like 2010s right-wing discourse is I fear that a lot of people, you know, without being too controversial, without stepping on too many toes, I feel like a lot of people, they want, you know, glorious, gay, automated, luxury space fascism, and it's sort of like, I don't know, you have to, like, there's one thing to take the tools of your enemy and sort of re-engineer them, but then when it just becomes, like, your vision of the future becomes, you know, a very placid form of what was ostensibly earlier iterations of liberalism. I mean, and even NRX, like, suffered from this as well. There really is not a powerful motivation there to explore a new aesthetic space, whatever that may look like. I mean, this is a question that I've struggled with for years now. What does a new aesthetic space in these spheres even look like, apart from something like Fashwave?
Oh, yeah, Matt, you mentioned my article on pan-enclavism and that kind of mixed reviews. And
well, the one guy said it was the most racist thing he's ever seen, this UCLA guy. So,
oh, yeah, like, I guess I had another article, like, on a similar theme, like, Amarin posted it, and some of the comments were dismissive. So some, I think, like, both the left and the right and the kind of normie centrist types are pretty uncomfortable with the idea, but it does seem to be the direction of, like, where we're headed. And, yeah, I plan on recording a show on just this topic. And there are criticisms that it will lead, like what you said earlier about the quote from Nietzsche, like needing, like, Nietzsche's quote and the kind of right-wing quote that multiculturalism leads to fragmentation and, like, a weakened nation. And I get that, but, like, I basically support this because I think it's the best or at least bad option of all the options that are presented, and I don't really see any alternative. But what are your thoughts on this whole idea of pan-enclavism? There isn't even, like, one agreed-upon term. It's kind of just, like, a thought experiment. You could say it's, like, right-wing multiculturalism. But what are your thoughts on its viability and how it relates to, like, Canada as a post-national nation?
I think that, in a sense, we kind of do live in, like, now that a lot of, like, certain forms of right-wing discourse, either through, like, repeated bannings or just people leaving, I think we do exist within, like, a weird form of right-wing multiculturalism in the sense that we have different, like, disparate groups all together and sometimes even divided on ethnic lines, but that seem to, like, get along, like, you know, like, Mediterraneans like us, like me, for instance, can get along with the Slavs. And but at the same time, I think that this neo-enclave idea, it is, I hate to say it, is kind of like the least bad, because, like, what's going to be the future, like, sectarian violence? Is that, like, some kind of, like, weird, like, Turner Diary race war fantasy? It's not, I hate to say it, but that's not in the, I mean, it could be, but
yeah, like, a lot of right-wing fantasies about their vision for the future are just copes. I think this is basically the only way to fulfill a lot of the objectives, but it's also the most practical and realistic, despite its flaws. But I think the right, like, you have, like, the kind of ethno-nationalist right, but also kind of the normie, like, the more normie center-right types who view being American as something kind of sacred that's beyond one's ethnic heritage. You have, like, that, too. I think the right, I mean, the left is, my reactions from leftists were mixed. Some left-wing types seemed open-minded, but there's a few, obviously a few comments that were pretty nasty. And then I think, like my article, my other article, New Pluralist Agenda for California, got posted on Jared Taylor's American Renaissance. And I'd say, like, out of the comments, like, the majority of them were kind of dismissive for those critiques that, basically the critique that the right has that diversity weakens, like, the nation. That's expected, but I do predict that this type of politics will really catch on in the future.
Well, I hate to say it. I hate to break it to all of my American friends out there, and I don't say this with any sort of confidence, because I wouldn't wish this upon my enemy, but if you look to Canada, like, I know people used to talk about the Sweden model.
I think I even referenced Canadian multiculturalism in the article I do, yeah.
Yeah, you did. I would say that, okay, here's the thing. I say the Canada model because I think that's sort of where America's heading, especially if the Kamala administration, because, you know, what's going to happen with Biden. If the Biden-Kamala administration gets their way, you'll sort of have, like, this odd reconquista of, like, center, lib, neoliberal politics, and everyone's sort of looking to Justin Trudeau as the model, like, the model puppet of governance in the future, in at least in terms of elite circles. And I think that the reason Canada has made it quote-unquote work is because there is, like, a large ethnic, there is, like, like outside of the big cities, there still is a large, like, white majority population. There are certain areas that have indigenous people that are in the majority, but by and large, it's mostly, like, Anglophone, Francophone, then, like, you know, Euro immigrants, like, you know, my family that came here in, like, in between the two world wars. But at the same time, in the big cities, the reason it quote-unquote works, Canadian multiculturalism, is because you do have very, like, dramatic ethnic enclavism, and it's just, like, you know, even Bimbo Ubermensch talked about this in the dating scene. Like, there just happens to be very strong ethnic lines in terms of, like, complete ghettoization.
So one part of it is ideology. There's this kind of ideology that America is, there's something magical and exceptional about America, but purely because of its ideology. That's part of it. But I also say, like, Canada, like, the immigrant communities, like, mostly from South and East Asia, like, are fairly recent. Well, America actually does have a lot of minorities who trace their family, like, way back.
Yeah, that's another thing, too, because Canada was always caught in between different worlds and in between two empires. Well, actually three, if you consider the French, but that was more in their declining period. But let's say three empires, Britain, France, and then America. And so it really didn't have a solid foundation. Now, there was a solid foundation before Trudeau came along in the 60s. I mean Trudeau's father, of course, Pierre. If you really want to trace what quote-unquote modern Canada is, then it really is Trudeau's daddy that sealed the deal in terms of Canadian multicultural experiment. But Canada used to have more of a sense of loyalist identity and purpose, either to France or to England. And the World War has really demonstrated the sort of the willingness to get the job done and sort of the hardness of class.
The French in Quebec, is the British influence, like, still noticeable?
Only as, like, a museum type of culture, but no, we are basically in Ontario and Vancouver. We are basically, like, America. And even in the West, I would say, though, I mean, as much as we are kind of like America, Canada, I would say, and, you know, this is a controversial take, we kind of are, like, more of a regionalistic culture than America is, in a sense of when you go to Alberta, things are, like, different than they are in Ontario, and you go to, like, Vancouver and Quebec, things are different. You go, like, down home, which, like, what we call down home is the Maritimes, like Nova Scotia, PEI. Those people are obviously different. Like, there are also different haplogroups. And I think that, like, America, as much as it is regionalist, there still is kind of, like, the uniting force, whereas Canada, I mean, if you talk to people in the Maritimes, if you talk to people in Alberta, they have, like, a much different negative opinion of people in Ontario than, like, we do of them, and it's for a good reason. So I would say Canada, in a way, we don't really have a unifying culture. We kind of are almost like a neo-enclave society already. But the problem is that there, overhead, there is like this totalizing, like, woke liberalism that has basically was a sort of bastardization from American liberalism that has infected the whole body. And we really didn't have any natural defense to it. This is basic. If you look up the author George Grant, he wrote this book, Lament for a Nation. He was a professor fairly close to me in Hamilton, and he wrote about how American multicultural liberalism, that it was going to colonize Canada, and that any sort of like right wing in Canada that used to be what they called high
Tory. So I guess to clarify, yeah. So Canada's existing political paradigm, is it an extension of the original Canadian multiculturalism from the 60s, which some could make as maybe like a watered-down version of what I'm advocating, or do you see it more as an extension of America's woke liberalism, or a combination of both?
Canada is, it's a combination, but I would say Canada is pretty much a petri dish of American woke liberalism, hence why I think the Canada model is more apt than the Scandinavian model, because Scandinavia has a number of quote-unquote problematic aspects to them that won't fly with American wokes. Canada really is like an accelerative, it's an accelerative form of like what the original, which was enshrined in the 60s in the Constitution with Pierre Elliott Trudeau. It really is like diversity is our strength sort of thing. And, you know, to tell you the truth, like there's some certain migrant populations I necessarily don't have a problem with, but I do think that in terms of the long-term demographic trends, I mean, you know, this is like typical argument. I think that it's going to create more problems as time goes on. And just even if the people are the nicest people in the world, it's just you can't really kind of have a functioning civilization where different people have different notions of what governance and culture is. But the only way that is that's maintained is if you have a very like top-down elitist class, which in some strange ways the Canadian political class is even more entrenched and even more like unified than it is in America, believe it or not. I mean, the sort of American political tribalism, I mean, it's there, but the political ruling class is much more unified than people like to think. I mean, certainly more unified than the Democrats and the Republicans, although the Democrats and the Republicans, you know, I mean, they're, let's face it, they're in it together. It's all kayfabe, right? It's all a work. But in Canada, there really is, our political system, our parliamentary system is almost designed to have a greater degree of political autonomy in terms of the political ruling class. So.
Oh, yeah. Those are the trends that I see. But I did notice that you responded to a tweet by Claire Lehman of Quillette, and she's kind of a perfect example of kind of intellectual dark web type who wants to kind of like freeze. She wants to freeze the world like permanently in the liberalism of the 90s. But you did respond. She had a tweet. I think it was about incels, but she kind of like racially tinged it. And her response, it seems like kind of a pretty standard, like kind of pull you up from your bootstraps response.
Yeah, but that type of response, you have to notice that the woke neoliberal order, they will reappropriate like boomer 80s conservative talking points when it's convenient to them, when it's sort of disenfranchises the large like young
male.
She's
not woke, but she kind of wants have it both ways. She wants to oppose wokeness, but she wants to freeze things in the liberalism of her youth. Like, that's the type.
And notice how she'll like signal switch when it's convenient. So, I mean, and I have no love for this man, but she recently went after James Lindsay.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. She called him racist because he said that critical race theory was actually against white people, as opposed to just saying that it was bad because it goes against classical liberalism, which obviously is her stance.
Yeah, so she'll, like, this is my big problem with the IDW is that, well, first of all, they're not real intellectuals, let's face it, but like they will very much soil themselves when it's convenient, and they will sort of play catch up to the globo-liberal order when push comes to shove. And It's sort of like what Cicero said. What did he say? A traitor inside is probably worse than a standing army at the gates. So, yeah.
Gio, you were making the point that a lot of woke types will sort of regurgitate like these, like Reagan era, like bootstraps conservative mentalities.
Yeah, like they'll sort of apply the same language of welfare queenism to like people in Appalachia, like the sort of the decimated white working class. Matt, you had a point earlier? Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, yeah, they do utilize that 80s bootstraps rhetoric. I mean, there's famous examples of the National Review, which is obviously different than the
yeah.
idea, but they'll also do the same. I mean, I just have to wonder. I'm not even, my views are not that extreme. Like, I'm not one of these people who's like, never punch right, never punch right. Like, obviously people have more moderate views and have a prerogative to defend them. But yeah, at this point, in 2021, I don't understand how you have people who really think that it's going to pay to you know, draw these red lines. Like, we never talk about white people being oppressed. So that seems to be what Lehman was doing, even though it's a clear reality to anyone.
With Claire Lehman, and there were two examples. There was her tweet on incels, then her tweet about Lindsay and ethnocentrism and CRT.
Like, if it's 2015, like, the so-called alt-light and stuff, like, I'm a little bit dissympathetic to the reasons why people at that time would have been like, well, maybe we should try and, you know, have good PR. Let's strike, like, a moderate-sounding position. But in the context of 2021, I don't understand. It's so obvious that
it's impossible.
You're better off just being honest, at least, which a lot of these people aren't. And a lot of these people want to police what can be said or not.
What he said that's like CTR, he said like that, I mean, yeah, Lindsay said that it was explicitly anti-white. I think the other example is Richard Hanania. He actually opposed CRT, but he said the roots of it were the 60s era civil rights movement, which really goes against like the kind of basic bitch conservative where they're against CRT, but they also love, like, Reagan and MLK.
Yeah, exactly. They are still, they're still, like, convinced of the idea of, like, meritocracy in America, which was, I hate to say, like, spurious at best. I mean, even in, back in the 50s, that was sort of, like, but it is kind of interesting what you bring up, Matt, about the alt-light. It's very funny seeing their progression to people that were, as time went on, like, more of them were more comfortable with, like, what you consider quote-unquote far-right positions, which, I mean, really, they weren't exactly far-right about, like, 20 years ago, but some of them have just, like, completely defected to, like, BreadTube, which is leftist YouTube, and they were total cowards and total sellouts, and it's very interesting how
it's so weird. Scene, which kind of brings this conversation a little bit back to when you're talking about Journey to the Vapor Island earlier. I mean, it was just such a different time. Those times are long gone. I mean, the alt-right doesn't really exist anymore. The alt-right definitely doesn't exist. Like, it's completely dissolute.
Or post-right, like, yeah, these terms get thrown around, the post-right and the post-left, which I don't even, like, there isn't even a clear definition, but it's post-everything.
I think whatever time period, just politically now I'm speaking, in terms of alternative politics and, you know, more fringe dissident politics, whatever period we're in now, I don't think there's any point in trying to label it because I think it's an in-between.
There still is some implicit influence from Frog Twitter. There was even, I was in it long enough to remember when a lot of this discourse came out of, like, a number of forums, came out of, like, my posting career, came out of Salo forums, and then all of them just decided to go on to Twitter. But a lot of the discourse, like, I mean, but then you had, like, popularizers, you have, like, you know, the America First people, and then you have others, and before them, and you had Gamergate, and sort of this mishmash of, like, dissident culture that in some ways was a failed alchemy, my only white pill, I mean, even the language of pills, that's like, you know, but my only white pill is that people are going to get more serious and they're going to potentially get more intellectually and artistically creative as.
Oh yeah, I would say that for sure. Yeah. Like, I think a lot of political stuff seems to be like a cope or just a waste of energy, but yeah. I'd like to see more channeling into like a artistic, creative, intellectual movement, like sort of like a new Bohemians, if that sounds cliche.
Yeah.
Like a new secessionist movement, I would say.
The silver lining of a time period like this on online and on Frog Twitter, whatever you want to call it.
But secession, not in a not so much in a physical political sense.
No, I'm talking the Vienna secession.
Exactly.
Vienna secession. They were a rejection of the sort of stuffy 19th century classicism within the French Academy, and they helped create. What came after them was Art Nouveau and Art Deco, and they were led by luminaries like Gustav Klimt, and they really believed in combining like a total work of art. So they would combine craft with interior design, with painting, and they believed that you have to go back to these more traditional art practices, but for artworks that weren't like quote-unquote trad in the sense of 19th century academic painting. And they really believed in having like an organic, holistic, like social movement even that embraced a very, very particular, like crafty type of aesthetic. And I think that in some ways, if we're going to have an art movement on the political right, I think we have to look at what the Vienna secession, what they were doing.
Like Italian futurist.
Or Italian futurism. Yeah.
Well, I think the time is right now because as Robert said, anything dealing directly with politics seems like,
like all these people talking, getting also, all pumped up about Rick DeSantis. And yeah, it's like, I mean, I don't have a problem with like voting for him, but it's just the whole kind of like the political savior mentality.
Yeah, it's not going to be Trump 2016 again. Obviously, Trump 2016 wasn't a savior either, but at least aesthetically, it was.
It was an impulse. Yeah, it was the last gasp.
But so, like in this period. When that kind of thing does seem useless and potentially dangerous to engage with politics directly, I do think engaging with the artistic and intellectual end of things is good, like soul building for whatever comes.
Yeah.
So, Gio, you're a fan of the true crime prison YouTubers, and I've actually been getting in on that scene a bit. Actually, I have an interview with like a prison guard that I'll probably upload to Star Truth TV pretty soon, but you have like Wes Watson and the guy Sean Atwood from the UK and Big Herc talks about wig splitting and busting cheeks. So is it just entertainment or do you have some kind of like unique philosophical take on the prison YouTubers?
Before, just like one quick last point, I think that politics, there are people doing serious intellectual work. Like, I mean, even like people on YouTube, I think like in order to survive as like someone on the right on YouTube, you sort of have to be a bit more clever and creative. And I think that it's a good thing that all these grifters sort of slowly got bodied over time. But let's just put a cap on that. The prison YouTubers, I think that it's really great how they're exposing like a culture within a culture in American society. I think like people don't realize just how massive the prison industrial complex is. And I think, like, in some ways, it's one of the only avenues in American society where people get to encounter more of a primordial type of existence. I mean, that's incredibly negative and destructive, obviously. But it's like what Big Herc says, like, oh, you're in there with some barbarians, man. It's like, it's true. It's like this joke that the comedian Tim Dillon said. He's like, what about the people that went to prison and realized that prison's the only fair place left in this society? It's kind of true. Prison, like war, gives you sort of a weird clarity. I mean, I've never been to prison, but from what they describe, it gives you like a weird clarity in life that's severely lacking in all of like total deracinated hyper-real Americana. It's like prison's the only form of American subculture that has like a very dramatic form of simplistic existence that I think people in some ways crave, ironically enough. That's why they're so popular. I mean, it's the only, you know, so.
Like, it would seem that prison is pretty much the one of the last spaces in American life and in the West where you can actually go and experience power dynamics fairly undisguised. I mean, you're there, the strong survive mentally, physically, like there's a clear hierarchy. Contrast that with the aesthetics we were talking about earlier, the aesthetics of concealing power, of being, you know, kind of self-effacing, that kind of neoliberal, like, not garbing yourself in the garb
Mark of Mark Zuckerberg purple shirt and jeans.
That's kind of an interesting contrast, I would say. Like, that. Not that it's good to go to prison, but it, when you hear about, even just watching the YouTube videos, it's access to, like, it's what, you know, Bapp talks about this a bit too. Not that he endorses prison or even talks about it, but, like, it's one of these untamed space, even though it's prison, so you're totally, you know, subservient to a system. At the same time, the social dynamics themselves are this, like, uncharted space where, like, there's still a bit of nature to it, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Wild so, nature.
There was a post on Sala Forum that Nicholas Sala linked to about the meme of how it's kind of used as, like, a threat against the middle class. It's really ingrained in American culture and media, but he made the comparison to the Soviet Union, and that's an interesting kind of sociological take. And then also, Coach Blackpill had a video, and I don't know if you've seen it, his critique of kind of that the prison YouTubers
exploit.
Yeah,
he hates those, yeah.
Yeah, he hates like Wes them. Watson, that they kind of, I mean, a lot of them do, like, they are playing up the role, because Wes Watson, like, he's, like, screaming, he's yelling at you, and, like, you literally see, like, the spit just, like, pouring at your face. And, like, yeah, a lot of it, yeah. But he does say that they kind of exploit and they glorify that life for profit. And he thinks, like a misguided young guy might actually think it's cool and go out and commit a crime. And then he also has a critique of the prison morality, like comparing. He gives an example of comparing a guy who commits an armed robbery and actually murders someone to, like, a kind of a statutory rape offender. So your thoughts on like the Coach Blackpill video and then the Solo forum thread?
I think I maybe have come across the Sala Forum thread as well. I think that, well, judging by the threads in Sala Forum, I think I pretty much know what the line is. There are a lot of creative, amazing things have come out of Sala, but when it comes to prison, I can kind of almost guess what they're going to talk about. I think that Devin, he's right in one sense.
Coach Blackpill or Sala?
Yeah, Coach Blackpill. Yeah, yeah. That's his name, Devin Stack, or... no, sorry, that's the Blackpill guy, sorry.
No. I think Coach Blackpill's from New Zealand.
Yeah, okay. I watched that video. Sorry, I'm talking about Devin Stark, the Blackpill guy.
Oh, yeah.
Totally different, yeah.
And the thing is, with Coach Blackpill, he's actually not, like, a full... He doesn't describe himself as, like, an incel. He tries to present himself as more kind of nuanced. Like, some people might criticize him as being, like, a triangulating kind of centrist type.
No, in some ways, yeah. But that video, I don't think that Wes Watson and these prison YouTubers, they glorify it necessarily, because they go at great lengths to describe the pain and agony. Sorry, pain and agony. The pain and agony that it, like, the toll it takes on just the human psyche and the human spirit to actually go through prison. But I can kind of see where, like, you know, less intelligent youth, they sort of see it as glorifying. But at the same time, I think that, yeah, it's true. The, like, prison morality is very brutal and terrible.
And even with that, like, I've heard some people, like, the concept of prison justice, like...
Yeah,
I've also heard some people say that it's kind of overhyped and over-exaggerated.
It depends where you are. Like, a lot of people
that
do
makes
say...
Sense,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, like, I know the northern states, they say it's not as common. I know in Canada, the prisons... they're not as divided by race. I mean, it depends on... if you go west, like, there's certain indigenous gangs, and if you go, like, near here, there's Muslim gangs. But it's not as much, like, to the degree as the California prison system. But I know that sexual assault does happen in Canadian prisons, but I think that it's not as, like, codified as a form of punishment. I know certain northern states, if you ask a lot of ex-cons, they, like, almost get offended at that assertion that, like, prison rape is, like, a common thing. But I do think that the threat of prison rape, which I think the Sala Forum's...
I think he's talking about, like, towards, like, focusing on the class angle as a deliberate mechanism of social control, but not against the criminal class, against, like, the middle class from revolting. And I have no idea if that's... that's deliberate, but it is kind of a theme in Hollywood films, and he makes the comparison to the Soviet Union.
I think in some ways it's true in the sense that the Soviets had a carceral system, especially in its declining period, that was, in some ways, they had no control over and was autonomous, and they created their own culture onto themselves. And you had, like, a lot of, like, these vicious, like, athletes and bodybuilders that were in the military, then they went to prison, that they didn't know what to do. So then you had, like, a lot of, you basically, like, had goons for hire. I mean, Bap was talking about this. But in the Soviet prison systems, there was a lot of crossing over with the quote-unquote middle class. I don't know if you could even describe it that way in the Soviet Union, because there was just such a sheer volume of political prisoners. Whereas in America, and, like, I mean, North America in general and Europe, I think that the prison system, it's starting as, you know, as offshoring becomes, like, the effects of it become more well-known as the opioid crisis continues. I do feel that the middle class, they're going to rub up against the prison system in America more frequently. And as that happens, things are going to get quite a bit more terrifying. And you're going to see the physical effects of total civilizational decay.
I mean, society as a whole has obviously declined. But, like, if you're talking specifically about prison, like, I've heard that maybe there was an era, like, in the 70s and 80s when things were much worse than they are today.
It was totally more brutal in the 70s and 80s, yeah. Yeah. Nowadays, it's not as bad in terms of, I mean, there's still massive amounts of violence and sexual assault, but compared to what happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, like, the OG prisoners, the stories that they tell, I mean, it kind of makes, like, modern prisoners look kind of, like, more tame by comparison. But I do feel that as the middle class enters into the carceral system, the carceral regime, We're probably going to see, like, the same sort of social contagions that happened throughout society in the Soviet Union. Of course, this is all predicated on things getting worse, which I think maybe is kind of inevitable. Because the American carceral system, that is, like, one of the few job creators in America left, which is terrible.
Because there is a push on the left to end mass incarceration. Obviously, like, on civil liberties, like, they're full of shit, depending on which group you're describing. Yeah. But I could see a scenario where they end mass incarceration, but then it's replaced by a more kind of oppressive surveillance state.
It will be a more oppressive surveillance state, but it'll also have the sort of trends of psychomedicalization that is present within, like, the therapy industrial complex. But I think the more realistic option is that they'll literally have, like, critical race theory woke prison systems, where to some degree they have this in Canada and elsewhere, where certain minorities will get certain exceptions. And like, okay, here's the thing, controversial take, especially in our spheres, I do think the American prison system is kind of, like, racialized to a degree, but I think that as time goes on, you will start to see the dregs, like the decimated husk of the white working class, they'll also be subjugated to forms of carceralization that the Black American population has went through. But I do think there is a case to be made that it is true there is a degree of racialization. I am not, certainly not one of these, like, conservatives that just dismiss it offhand. There has been cases of vast injustices.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But at the same time, I think that this system is going to get to a degree where other forms of even the white majority is going to start feeling it as well.
Kind of relevant to the meme of woke, the woke austerity meme, relevant to that.
Yeah, exactly, the woke austerity, yeah. So they'll start to have, I think that it is true that the Black community is kind of targeted for criminalization, but at the same time, if they're going to go with some form of, like, woke criminal justice, that's just going to, like, you know, it goes without saying it's going to cause more problems than it solves. But I think the American justice in general is such a broken system. Because I remember someone said this, I think it was in a YouTube comment or it was on Twitter. It was some griper or someone that said, you know, the people that probably deserve the American prison system, we should basically execute them anyways. We should have much more, like, easily accessible death penalty results. But the people that don't deserve to be in prison, they probably shouldn't be in a situation where they're counting
that's
locked
kind of,
up.
I think you can make the case that the criminal justice system, penal system, is analogous to overall political trends. Because if a hard right came to power, they would probably have, like, mass executions of the worst of the worst. And if maybe a genuine or positive version of the left came to power, they would try to make things more humane. But I think these conditions are symbolic of overall political trends. I think the word, like, neoliberal is kind of a bit cliche and overused, but I do think it's kind of symbolic of how mass society and the political system combines, like, the worst elements of, like, the left and the right.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Totally. Yeah.
It's like what Zizek said. He said that, the Nazis, they would just basically execute people. They would, like, get rid of you. They would literally disappear you. Whereas, like, the Soviet, he said, like, they wouldn't, they would spare you the humiliation of a show trial, because the Soviets, they had the mindset of, like, this is a terrible injustice you're committing against our glorious utopian system, and how dare you escape the longhouse of the Soviet mother, right? I think, like, in the same sense, if the far right were to take power in America, I mean, granted, if it was, like, if it had, like, an intelligence to them, if it wasn't just, like, this, like, boomer Fox News revenge fantasy, I think that they probably would, you probably would have, like, some form of, like, mass execution of, like, the worst criminality in society. But at the same time, I feel that the approach a lot of people on the right have, I truly think, like, a lot of crimes that are punished in America probably don't deserve to be, but, like, the more severe stuff, like, you know, murder, serial murder, sexual assault, rape, like, those things, I think, like, yeah, I mean, I'm not, when I was younger, I thought the death penalty was kind of, like, not good, but now I think that there's just certain people you can't have in society.
Well, there's, like, the argument that about the chance of innocence.
Oh, that's another thing, too. I think, like, in order to have a system where you have executions by the state, I think there's been terrible cases of misjustice. But at the same time, to me, the way that they do the executions is, like, through, like, trying to be quote-unquote humane. To me, it kind of looks actually more inhumane to just, like, stick a needle in your in these prisoners and just let
them... It's more about the aesthetic to the viewer. I mean, that actually seems...
Yeah.
There was South Carolina wanted to bring back, like, the firing squad, and they let the condemned person decide. But it's more about... A lot of it's more about, like, the visual to the public as opposed to what actually causes the most horrific suffering.
Well, that's what I mean. They've said that the lethal injection actually causes probably more suffering to the prisoners. I mean, I have to see the studies on it, but to me, just, like, in terms of just the spiritual aspect of it, I mean, a firing squad or being hung, that's, like, a way more nobler death than just fading off into oblivion. I think, like, unironically, we have to bring back the firing squads.
No, so... I've actually spouse that, like, literally verbatim here, but there's something extremely, and I am pro-death penalty, but there's something extremely disturbingly clinical about the lethal injection.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah.
I would, if I were going to be put to death for some reason, I would much rather...
The most humane would be putting someone to sleep first, and then, like, a guillotine would be, like, the most humane, probably.
I don't know. There's just something, like, and maybe death row inmates don't deserve this honor, but, like, I don't know. The best way to go out, as Gio said, you know, maybe it's all aesthetics, but, like, firing squad has a certain martial flavor to it, which I think would be, you know, acceptable, and then
like hanging, that Goya painting.
Classic. Yeah. But
it's something that is... Like, the way that we treat death, even, especially in the last few years, the fact that we have such a pervasive society of, you know, Ernst Becker's concept of death denial, it seems that it's everywhere, and that even though the sort of aesthetics of hypermodernity is so clinical and dead and medicalized...
Do you think it's atheism, or that's too, like, basic bitch kind of conservative?
In some sense it is, but at the same time, we are seeing sort of, like, weird forms of politicized re-enchantment that are almost Gnostic in character, but it is kind of, I think when it comes to, like, people at the top, especially, like, the Silicon Valley bug men and, like, the neoliberal order, I think that it is kind of, like, they're trying to force a form of disenchant, like a disenchantment that comes off as atheistic but still has immensely negative spiritual power that controversial take, but I don't believe there's any, like, true atheism out there, in my opinion. I think that everyone has a spirituality, whether you want to like it or not.
Wokeness is definitely a religion, but that's kind of brought up now, because now the right says wokeness is a religion, but before they would say that the left was actually, 10 years ago, you had, like, conservatives saying that the left was, they lacked any moral foundation, which that's obviously nonsense.
Relativism.
More relativism. Yeah. I think, Bill O'Reilly, like, those boomer cons from a decade ago, back then, but that's not the case now.
And what they were doing, they were basically LARPing the godless communism meme in the 80s. I think that, like, the relativism thing, it worked for a time, and there was a period in the late 90s, early 2000s, where the left sort of, boomer conservatives like Mark Stein talked about how the left, they, like, shed their spiritual skin, they got rid of the New Age, like, woo, and they, like, they dived headfirst into, like, the new atheist movement. But that really only served for a time, because, let's face it, like, new atheism, it's mostly, like, a upper-middle-class white man endeavor. It's not going to serve the spiritual needs of, like, the what do they call it? The MB baby witches on TikTok.
Oh, right, like, yeah.
Yeah, so...
We're getting close to the end of the show, but I do want to go back to, Gio, your art background. If you just want to talk about your artistic influences, and do they coincide with your political and philosophical influences? And then do you have any thoughts on just kind of the overall, like, economic and political mechanisms of the arts and viability of making a living as an artist?
Oh, well, the last one, no. Is unless something changes. I mean, I'd be glad if Peter Thiel or someone gives me some money. But in terms of my influences, I'm very much influenced by a lot of different things. And Matt, I do want to hear your point before the end of the show. But really quickly, I'm influenced by a lot of German Expressionism, a lot of the Impressionists, a lot of the New York School, believe it or not, and even people that came before them in the more of the Seattle area, what they called in the 40s and 50s, the Northwest Visionaries. So painters like Mark Toby, Morris Graves. In terms of politics, I'm very much influenced by painters and artists and people that were doing traditional crafts like printmaking, which is something that I do. People that were operating within the lens of aesthetic modernism, but yet had a very primordial, almost traditional type of message. Even painters like Gauguin and, to an extent, Picasso, depending on his period. I'm not a big fan of Picasso. I'm more of a fan of people like Mark Toby, people like Jackson Pollock, Edvard Munch, even like what you would consider quote-unquote degenerate artists like Francis Bacon, I'm hugely influenced by. And I know shout out to my friend Paul Talk on YouTube, I know he'd be horrified by me listing all of these people, but I am influenced by a lot of diverse, sources, but I think that in some ways they do influence a bit of my politics, but I think that art in some ways should transcend politics, and even though all art is inherently political at the face of it, I think that we should strive to have art should be a spiritual endeavor, as cliched as that sounds. It should be something that transcends merely propagandistic political aims, because at the end of the day, we have to face the reality that we are all in this sort of, like, you know, Paul Klee's Angel of History, looking back at the horror and the wreckage of the pileup that is history. And even though that sort of messianic transcendence, it may not be on the horizon, we still have to create the work of art, whether it's literature or painting or printmaking or music. We still have to operate within the lens of there being a reconciliation of history itself. So Matt, please finish your point. We cut you off.
No, I won't, because I think that's such a good place to end the show. I mean, I was some other aside about new atheism or something, but I don't think it's super relevant, and I think that Robert should end the show on that monologue. Very interesting and very true.
Oh, well, thank you, guys.
One last point about the arts is kind of how we had the postmodernist era in art, but then a lot of these kind of like 80s illustrators. I don't know if you're familiar, like I mentioned Jim Buckles with the Blower Guy show, and the other artist, I forget his name, who does these kind of like Victorian kind of dollhouse type illustrations, but like architectural. Like, they're kind of pop art, but they're more, they seem to be like they're influenced by Art Nouveau and Surrealism, but how kind of pop art, because it's sort of like how traditionalists denounce, like, there's these different layers, like some traditionalists denounce the all art from since Impressionism or everything from the 20th century, and then some will just denounce art from like the postmodernists, like since the post-war era. But it is interesting how a lot of the pop art, a lot of the great pop art that came from that era, like including the 80s, even though like Nagel, like the artist Nagel's a bit more like mass-produced, more kind of cliche, but his stuff is definitely influenced by Art Deco. And then, like, there's Jim Buckles, and then the other artist, I forget his name, into, like, the dollhouses.
Well, I'm influenced by a lot of, like, the later 20th century people. Like, I've written a lot about them. I have to actually go back to some art writing. But I've written about, like, Andy Warhol and Anselm Kiefer and people like that.
What do you think about, like, David Hockney and Wayne Thiebaud?
Okay, it depends what era of Hockney or Thiebaud. I think that his recent stuff,
his recent one of the London Underground looked,
or even,
that was pretty silly.
I've written in defense of his cathedral work, but I honestly believe that someone should just, like, glue paintbrushes to his hand and take away his iPad. I mean, it's not serving humanity any justice. I think that Hockney's one of the few pop artists I actually do like. I mean, him and Keith Haring. I'm not a big fan of pop art. I'm much more of the...
What about Wayne Thiebaud, like his architecture, and then his famous ones of the cakes?
I think it was good for that era. Like, it's certainly very interesting. But, like, in terms of, like, the mass-produced, like, kitschy, like, type of pop art, like, you know, Leyendecker or... Rauschenberg or people like that. I think that
Rauschenberg is the prince from the 80s.
Yeah. Like it's just, I think that as much as I do like the sort of lowbrow comic stuff, I think it's very interesting. Pop art, like the way it sort of mutated in the 80s and then the 90s, some people like used it as an excuse for artistic laziness, which I mean certainly nowadays the poppers that like just gaudy, terrible, like sexually charged stuff that people like Jerry Saltz likes, it gives pop art a bad name. But I'm definitely like I think like in terms of like the aesthetic vision of in the contemporary world nowadays, there really is like such an eclecticism that leads to blandness. And like I was talking about this even today with my good friend Adam Lehrer, the infamous art critic, about how it seems that the hyperpoliticization of the contemporary art world has like killed its spirit faster than even like zombie formalist trends of like neo pop art or neo expressionism or whatever, or like now artists are going back to painting, but now it's like woke figure painting. And it's like, you know, it's trying to LARP something, but it's like a reappropriation of it. And to me, as much as I want to defend certain contemporary artists, and I think that there still is value to be had in the contemporary art world, they really make it a difficult job for someone like me on the political right to say, even though you may hate Sanford Biggers, you may hate this like monstrosity, and that's a very hateable monstrosity at Rockefeller Center, There, it still says something about our epoch that is at least worthy of an intellectual exploration, maybe not so much an aesthetic or emotional or spiritual exploration, but I do feel that a lot of these trends, they're there for a reason, and it's becoming of us to truly analyze where these things have come from.
With the Rockefeller statue, the African statue, it's not what it says about the aesthetic trends beyond politics, because it's very different from a lot of the kind of minimalistic
Yeah.
And also postmodernist sculptures that were popular a decade or two ago.
Oh, it's totally the opposite. This is what Sanford Biggers wants. I mean, not to show my podcast, but if you look at Style Talks number 5, we talk about how Sanford Biggers is a total maximalist in terms of his, what he called, it's part of his series he called the Chimera series, where he basically takes like very gaudy and terrible appropriations of European, quote-unquote classic Hellenistic European art and mashes them together with like very bad appropriations of quote-unquote African art, or rather what he perceives to be African art, and he makes this like weird like Metis like mix of this like neo Harlem Renaissance, what he's trying to do, sort of type of artwork. And this is the product that is produced, is this huge bronze monstrosity that has nothing of the, it's a, in some ways it's almost like an ambitious rejection of a lot of like minimalism and postmodern art that
you
was,
could even say like a lot of people in our sphere are critical of minimalism.
Yeah,
but minimalism is also, in some ways, it is very, it's very, a very kind of white aesthetic genre, and like a lot of these like more like non-Western cultures that are being promoted by wokeness. If you look at Islamic art, Hindu art, East Asian art, and in Latin America too, it's extremely maximalistic.
Oh yes, very much so. But it's maximalistic in the sense that, especially with Islamic art and with with, you know, I mean, when I went to grad school, I my whole thing in my philosophy MA was about Zen and Chinese ink paintings, and you have a purposeful lack of figuration as opposed to Western, especially in Islamic art, because it was apocryphal, it was haram to depict people in art, and they found ways around it, but they created almost this beautiful proto-abstraction in the Islamic art world. But when it comes to like maximalism, I think that it's, in some ways it's true that like minimalism is like a white form of art, but it's very much like white beyond the more northern parts of the Hajnal line, if you know what I mean. It's white in the sense of like very northern European to almost Germanic to an extent. But when it comes to like Mediterraneans or Slavic people like me, being Mediterranean, to me, minimalism, as much as I appreciate it on an intellectual level, is kind of like alienating to me, I'm not going to lie. It's alienating to my Mediterranean sensibilities. So, I mean, coming from like an Italian, like very maximalist aesthetic culture, I do appreciate Scandinavian quietism, especially with the works of Edvard Munch. I do appreciate when an artist can restrain him or herself. And it's, you know, a lot of my artwork is very single subject orientated, because I feel like, even in just in terms of my artistic progression, I feel like there's certainly ambitious works I want to do, but for now I feel that it's very good to, as an artist, to recognize your limitations and your influences at face value. So yeah, but again, being like Italian, it's like almost a given that minimalism is going to wound my soul in some ways.
Gio, we're at the end of the show. Do you have any upcoming videos and projects or websites that you want to plug?
Just my YouTube channel, my Instagram. I'm working on a seller site with my co-host Lev. I just have to get around to putting product on it. Well, hopefully that will be out soon, so like people can buy my artwork directly. Other than that, I want to get back into writing. I'm going to be writing stuff for my friend Adam Lair's Substack called Safety Propaganda. And I want to, of course, write more stuff in like IM-1776 and American Sun. I haven't written American Sun in a long time. I really feel bad about that. I've just been lacking with writing. And I also have my own Substack, which I'm going to recently start publishing in. I think next week I'm going to release a piece on male fantasies and incels and things like that. So, yeah. Before I go, like, it's been amazing. Finally, on the Stark Truth, I mean, this has been such a great conversation. And, I love you guys' work. And this has been I mean, you've literally had so many great guests on. I feel very humble, my friend. So, my friends, yeah.
Thanks.
So,
yeah, it's been a great show, Gio Panaschietti. Great speaking with you, and check out his work online. And thanks, Matt Pegas, too.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. Yeah, this has been great. I loved your contributions, my friend.
Thank you.